Today, do we need to have a big, deep chat about how we consider the worlds of work, capital sharing and planning here in Australia? Well, that's the general idea behind the government's job summit coming up pretty soon, with echoes of those big meetings conducted in the early years of the Hawke government in the 1980s. We'll have a preview, hearing about the ACTU's contribution, which certainly puts its case seriously, attracting as a result some serious response from the business world and that of capital. We'll also hear of a fascinating American work crunching through huge amounts of Facebook data to draw some conclusions about mobility within communities, and our August edition of The Peak. Yes, some good suggestions about what to see, read and listen to in our second hour with the Pick. Jim Stanford from the Centre for Future Work joining us too with his big ideas commissioned by the ACTU, followed by the Facebook study about friendships across class. Well, it's turning into a brutal duel to the finish line on September the 5th in the race to become the next UK Prime Minister. The question is, does this race tell us much about the modern union or not? Vying for the Tory leadership is Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. She's positioning herself as the continuity candidate, having never resigned from Boris Johnson's ministry, and she's modelling her image on the Iron Lady herself, Maggie Thatcher. In the other corner, the suave, polished former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak. He's a very interesting star of modern British politics, and we'll hear why in a moment. Just weeks ago, he was viewed as the favourite to win the race, but he's now trailing Truss in polls of the Conservative Party members who get to elect the next leader. Yes, it's intriguing that the whole UK population awaits breathlessly the name of their new leader, determined by 175,000 Tory members. I'm pleased to welcome back to the program for his always perceptive analysis, former Tory MP and long-time contributor to RN, Matthew Paris. Hello there.
Hello, hello.
Do you think that this sort of epic drama does tell us a lot about modern England and UK, or not?
Well, not really. And in a way, the key to that is in what you said at the end, it's the 175,000. We don't actually know how many. Nobody knows how many. Well, perhaps the Conservative Party knows, but it's a secret. And it could be anything, really, between about 120 and 200,000. And it is they who are choosing their leader. They are not, in a sense, choosing the Prime Minister, but whoever is their leader will become the Prime Minister. And so the whole thing, the whole battle, is pitched towards this slightly shadowy group of people, some of whom, many of whom actually don't even do the internet, and many of whom don't answer their phones, and whose names we don't know. And even the polling of the so-called membership of the Conservative Party is a little bit mysterious, because you can't actually establish whether anyone is or isn't a member, and yet the polling has led quite a lot of the battle. But the whole thing is pitched towards a certain kind of typical Tory who actually joins the party and pays their subscriptions, and that they're not necessarily representatives of the rest of the country.
Oh, well, I mean, they're not, are they? I think you can say that. I mean, they're largely white, are they not, that which we know? And you've got a very multicultural country. I mean, it honestly seems vaguely absurd to an Australian eye that this is the case.
Well, it is absurd. It's more than vaguely absurd. No, they're not representative, not just in terms of colour, but the most important thing, I think, would be class and financial status. Most are retired. Most are reasonably well off. Most would do well, for instance, out of tax cuts, and are not especially interested in welfare benefits. But we're going into a period where household prices are going to be going crazy, particularly on energy. And lots of younger families and people on lower incomes are really just worrying about how they're going to pay their bills. A lot of Tory members are not worrying about that, which is one of the reasons why Liz Truss has done rather better than expected. She just keeps talking about tax cuts. The rest of the country, much of it, are not interested at the moment in tax cuts. They have more pressing worries on their minds. But the party membership like the tax cut talk. Rishi Sunak, curiously, because he's really quite a right of centre, old-fashioned fiscal
market man, isn't
good
it?
Housekeeping kind of conservative, but he is he has had it, as it were, to go onto the other tack and start talking about the rest of the country and how we can help them, which is a good thing.
A third allegedly have already voted. Do you believe that?
I don't think anybody knows. Again, the sample what the pollsters have, we don't know how representative the sample is of actual Conservative members. I hope they haven't, because the whole point of this contest, and you know, the two would-be leaders are going around the country holding huge hustings everywhere. The whole point is to help the final voters, the Conservative Party members, make up their minds. So they shouldn't make up their minds yet. I doubt if it's as many as a third.
I suppose that's the other thing. You know, there's a humour around this, or sort of, but maybe they are sitting back there, for all we know, very charged with the weight of what they of their decision, listening very carefully. I mean, it's possible that they're taking it incredibly seriously and thinking of the broader country, isn't it?
They are taking it seriously, and I think they are very conscious of the weight on their shoulders. And I would go further than that. Quite a few Conservative voters, Conservative members I've spoken to, don't really think it is they who should be taking the decision at the moment. They're very conscious of not knowing enough about it all, and that they have selected a parliamentary candidate who has become their Member of Parliament in many cases, and they would have assumed that it would be the Members of Parliament who would be choosing. So they have had, to a degree, they're having this thrust upon them.
And just explain, is that a convention, is it, Matthew, that the members get the vote? Presuming it's not about being Prime Minister, it's about being leader of the party.
It is, and it's actually, people say it's a convention, but it's relatively recent. Up until about 40 or 50 years ago, even the Conservative MPs didn't choose their leader. It was chosen by consensus from the seniors of the party, and there was no definition of who the senior people really were or what the consensus was, and the leader just sort of emerged. Then they changed the system where you had a democratic vote amongst the members of the party, the Conservative MPs. Then they changed the system again, and the system now is the Conservative MPs come up with a short list of two, and they place that short list before the membership of the country. But this has only been going on for about, I think it's 15 or 16 years, and it's not clear to me that it's working or that it commands widespread assent.
Is race or gender a factor, in your view, as a decider?
There will be, in a certain section of the Conservative Party membership, a bit of rumbling about a man of Asian ancestry becoming leader of the party, but I don't think it's very significant anymore. And I think there will equally be a section of the Conservative membership that feel rather proud that we've had as our Chancellor of the Exchequer and might have as our Prime Minister as such a man. There's no longer any objection at all to having a woman as leader. That all faded in the early years of Margaret Thatcher's government. So Liz Truss is under no disadvantage through her gender.
And this issue around economic management of the country, how much is that being debated? Like that it's a very strong difference, isn't it? She's talking about tax cuts. He's saying they're irresponsible at the moment. So it's very different rhetoric. I just wonder. I mean, it does say, I suppose, a lot about the UK at the moment, how they're receiving that rhetoric, particularly in the wake of Brexit.
The rhetoric is very different. That the realities of their underlying positions are fairly far apart. They're converging a little bit. But basically, Liz Truss believes that it's all about economic growth. She's going to get economic growth. She's going to get economic growth by cutting taxes, by removing EU regulation that we don't need to abide by any longer, and by, as she keeps putting it, releasing the energetic spirits of the British entrepreneurial character. Once we've got growth, she argues, then the money will start coming in again, and then we'll be able to get the taxes to pay for stuff that we want. Rishi Sunak is more cautious, doesn't believe that just by cutting taxes you're going to get growth, and doesn't believe that you should increase spending by borrowing until the economy is on a more even keel. So he's much more the cautious of the two.
Yeah, and he's a fascinating character, isn't he? Tell us a little more about him, please.
Well, he's generally spoken of as immensely rich, and he is now immensely rich, but his origins are not particularly rich. His parents, his father was a GP, a general practitioner, doctor, and his father and mother together ran a chemist's shop in Portsmouth, where he comes from. He didn't quite get a scholarship to go to Winchester College, which is, of all our public schools — when I say public schools, I mean private schools, that's so English — of all our public schools, Winchester is the most intelligent. It's regarded as the place for really brainy kids, boys. And he went to Winchester. His parents scraped together the money to send him there. He came out of Winchester, went on to Oxford, did very well, made quite a lot of money in finance himself. He spent quite a bit of time over in California, and then came back and married one of the wealthiest women in the world. Shatka Murthy is her name, and she comes from an extremely wealthy, incredibly wealthy Indian family. So they are now both very wealthy indeed.
And the parents came from East Africa, didn't they? They migrated, I think, in about 1960 or something like that.
They did, yes. There was a great many Asian people in East Africa at that time, sent over in colonial days to work on the railways, who rose into a sort of class of middle managers and clerks, and then were driven out by one or two African dictators, particularly in Uganda, and were allowed, as it were, given refuge back in Britain.
Tim Bale is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, and he had this very interesting quote. He is, Rishi Sunak, in the end, perhaps just too shiny for the party membership. Although, the other thing is, he was one of the — I think he really led that last exit out of Boris Johnson's cabinet and said, "I can't sit here any longer." And the question is whether Tory values really will punish that, seeing it as disloyalty, whereas Liz Truss stayed in, and she's made quite a point of this. So again, the ghost of Boris Johnson sits there. Are either of them talking about having him in their cabinet, by the way, should they win?
Both of them have said they would be prepared to work in cabinet with the other one, but nobody can see how they could, because they've each accused each other of virtually immoral plans for the economy. She's called him a doomster. He's called her a sort of fantasist. And I don't think Rishi Sunak would sit in a Truss cabinet, and I don't think she would offer him the position that he wanted.
But what about Boris? Would they offer it to Boris? Would he to sit in there?
No. Privately, everybody senior in the Conservative Party, or most people senior in the party, think that Boris messed up pretty badly. Publicly, they won't say it, and for this reason, the Tory membership is very loyal, rather old-fashioned, and always loyal to whoever the leader is. And when the leader is removed, there's always a lot of unhappiness about it. There was about Margaret Thatcher challenging Ted Heath, and there has been about the challenge to Boris.
Is foreign policy playing a role at all?
No, not at all. They're both talking tough on China, which is what you have to do these days. They're both talking tough on Ukraine, which is what you have to do these days. And no discernible difference between the two of them has emerged.
In your view, because I think you have a vote, do you not? You're a member?
No, I'm no longer a member. I resigned my membership a couple of years ago. I wish I hadn't now.
In your view, who would be a better Prime Minister, given that I think it's 2.5 years till the next election, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Liz Truss is crackers. She's absolutely bonkers. Her ideas are just
really
off the scale. If we had a Truss premiership, it would all be spent with people trying to talk her out of the various things she said she's going to do. I mean, she actually seemed to be against welfare benefits at one point, saying they were handouts and she just preferred to cut taxes. So no, it would be Rishi Sunak. He's sensible. He's the grown-up in the room. He understands things. He understands figures. He has his defects, though. He is a bit shiny. He is a bit sort of PR polished. And there is a feeling sometimes with him, and he kind of confessed to it himself, that he drills down well into the detail of everything, but isn't always very good at standing back and looking at the wood rather than the trees. So that neither of them are perfect.
My goodness. Leadership is a very interesting topic, isn't it,
yes,
around the Western world these days. All right. Look, thank you as usual, Matthew. That's a wonderful overview. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Parris, a former Tory MP, though no longer a member, and I think I now remember that he did actually tell us that a couple of years back when he resigned. Up next, support for greater sanctions against the Taliban. What are the implications of that as we mark 1 year since the Afghanistan withdrawal?
Huddled beneath the wing, men clung to the undercarriage, but horribly not for much longer. When the jet's landing gear disappeared, so did their grip on life. Some fell to earth.
I have never felt it to this extent. Helpless, hopeless, disappointed, poor and miserable in my life. All over 20 years achievement maybe just go away in blinks of few days.
Now I lost my hope and I think it will not be an easy path for Afghan women. Now I feel like I'm in a tunnel, not very dark, but I can't see any bright light either.
They should not be scared. Their honor, their right to education, work, we have commitment for that. So they should not have worries, because we want to open a new chapter of peace, tolerance, peaceful coexistence, national unity.
A future Afghan government that upholds the basic rights of its people and that doesn't harbor terrorists is a government we can work with and recognize.
Taliban spokesman Sihal Shahim and the US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Ending that snapshot of Afghanistan 1 year ago, marked, if you recall, by much distressing footage of chaos. Well, this week marks the first anniversary of the Taliban's return to power, and the general view is that the worst fears have been realised, in particular the killing of the Al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri in a safe house in Kabul last month offered another illuminating insight into the terrorist group's close links to the Taliban. So what available options are there for the international community to help Afghans, particularly girls and women, and to ensure that the terrorism threat doesn't grow once again? Annie Pforzheimer is a former senior United States diplomat. She was chief of mission from time to time in Kabul during 2017 to 2019, at the time one of the largest American embassies in the world. And she has been commenting publicly, like other former ambassadors, on what strategies for influence might exist, because it's a little bit tricky. Annie, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
That audio clip is quite distressing, particularly that young woman feeling so desperate. Before we get into the analysis, I presume this is a rather difficult anniversary for you, given your work and connections with Afghanistan?
It is. And I think exactly what you had said, the worst fears were realized. Many people, like me, wanted to be wrong about our assessment, but we didn't see any possibility that the Taliban would change. And in fact, they feel encouraged to be even more draconian than they were in the 1990s.
Just before we again get into details, did you see at the time any chance of cooperating with moderates within that group? Because obviously this is a very important consideration for the rest of the world now. Could you identify anybody, or was that again something that you just thought eluded us all?
I don't think that there is such a thing as a moderate within the group who has any kind of decision-making power. There may be those who have more moderate views, but they are kept from the actual levers of decision-making, and they're actually used in a way just as a front for interaction with the United States and other Western countries. Now I don't think there was a missed opportunity to have spoken to a moderate along the way.
The US and Australia evacuated thousands of Afghans, although there's constant stories here about whether they really are being dealt with the way they ought to be. What have you personally heard about people who've remained behind and who are, for instance, connected to our security forces or the previous administrations? What are they doing to survive?
Well, unfortunately, there's some very accurate, well-documented reports of reprisal killings against people who served in allied security forces. Women who have protested, in the early days, we saw those protests. Many of those women have been detained, and the allegation is that they were tortured. And there are people who spend their lives now in hiding, moving house to house, or in many cases doing all that they can to get over the border to Pakistan or to Iran, where they run a very significant risk of being deported back to Afghanistan. And no country, I think, is doing enough to take care of the people left behind.
There are some reports that some have even joined the Taliban's enemies, ISIS, to survive. Have you heard that?
I have. I don't think it's, well enough documented, but it has a logic to it, because if they're going to defend themselves, they have to join a group that has some kind of firepower. And the Taliban and ISIS are battling for supremacy. So I don't have actual details at all, but I have heard those allegations.
The assurances in relation to human rights, particularly that girls would be allowed to go to school. Now, was there a period of waiting to see what would happen and of giving the Taliban a period of time to show the world how they'd govern?
I think that's exactly what there was. Between August and then March of this year, the U.S. and other countries, Norway, for example, held a conference in Oslo in January. That was a period of engagement. There are still many, many restrictions on things like assistance or recognition, but there was an engagement, the idea of trying to find a roadmap. And in March, with the reversal of a previous commitment to open girls' high schools, you've seen a real, sort of a frozen version of that. There are still meetings, but there's no sense of momentum or a direction towards an agreement. Essentially, it's become very tactical and based on, areas of negotiation over people who are left behind or over specific issues relating to humanitarian assistance.
Now, I just want you to develop that. You mean, when you say tactical, so there is movement in place, in places, in parts of it, are there, but not don't look for an overall movement?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's very issue-based, the conversations that are being had now. I don't think that there's this idea of a grand plan of how the Taliban might move towards, the three things that, let's say, they want. One is recognition, political recognition. The second is removal of sanctions. And the third is funding for anything other than humanitarian assistance.
There was a very interesting, very big piece in the New York Times magazine by a man called Matthew Alkins that was very interesting to read. I commend it to people, The Taliban's Dangerous Collision Course with the West. And he makes the point that it's a bit that whole issue with girls' education, which I think a lot of our listeners will be fascinated by, that right till the very last moment, it looked as though it was going to be okay, like till the opening of the school's date. And in fact, the people in Kabul, this is why I'm asking you about cracks within the Taliban, I suppose I'm searching for them, whether or not they exist. People in the Kabul part of the Taliban thought it was all going to be okay. And then Kandahar, which is where the more sort of conservative people are, decided at the very last minute against it and said, no, these high schools may not open. Now, is that your understanding of things?
Yes, that is my understanding, and I would draw from it a lesson of pessimism, which is that it doesn't really matter what the people in Kabul say. What matters is what they decide. And as I mentioned before, the moderates, the people who know how to talk to the West or who genuinely hold those views, they are not given decision-making authority.
Mm. Does that mean that women are now totally absent virtually from public view in Afghanistan? Is this what the consequence is?
Yes, that is the consequence. There are only really a few exceptions that women can work in the health sector, but women have lost their jobs with the government. Many of them obviously can't be teaching schools that aren't open. They are not allowed to go out by themselves. You know, widows and other women who might otherwise have to support a family are not able to, to have businesses that they operate. And women are being told all the time, obviously, about what they wear when they do leave the house. And it's an erasure. It is intentional, and it's something that the Taliban, they clearly feel is so important that they can watch over 90% of the country suffer food insecurity, but they spend pretty much all their time legislating how women dress and where they can go.
Yes, the big word that came out, the document, the decree on hijab or Islamic veiling that came out after the ban on girls' high schools, that was in March the 23rd, stated that effectively the best hijab of all, the decree noted, was staying at home. Male guardians, not women, would be punished for violations. The question was raised in this very good piece whether that does have a pertain in rural communities and conservative households, but that it may be a little gentler in the cities. But you're sort of suggesting no.
I don't have personal information. I mean, I think a case-by-case basis in Afghanistan, there are many people living in rural areas. There are also many in cities. There are the biggest cities that we know about, and then there are smaller ones. The provincial capitals, you know, I'm not really sure in the city environments whether there can be some kind of accommodation reached. But essentially, the rule is very strictly enforced. There's no reason to think that the Taliban don't mean what they say. And they have been, there have been documented issues where they were beating women for wearing the wrong kind of headscarf. Someone who wanted to go to university, which...
Oops, we've just suddenly lost her. What's happened there? We've obviously just got, we'll just try to find her again because I did wonder, are you there? You are there. Great. Look,
I'm right here.
Okay, it's just that we're losing you a little tiny bit, but I do want to ask you what options or levers are available to the international community to try to influence this then?
Well, there are sort of the three areas that I think I mentioned. On the issue of human rights, I think that's where all of our basket of diplomatic tools of recognition should be deployed. We should be telling the Taliban that adherence to human rights standards, the UN Universal Declaration, for example, that's what they need to do before we can consider political recognition or their seat at the United Nations. With respect to the sanctions, they are clearly out of compliance on counterterrorism. They are still hosting al-Qaeda and very senior leaders who are encouraging others to carry out attacks on the West. So the sanctions should remain in place, and the travel ban exemption, which was there so that they could travel for peace and stability discussions, I think that is a mockery that exemption is still in place, and it should be rescinded. And finally, if they want more money, they need to provide transparency about how money is being spent and, you know, what they would do with it.
Thank you very much indeed. Pity to have such a chorus of pessimism, but I can understand your logic. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Annie Forzheimer, a former senior American diplomat on the situation in Afghanistan. We'll be back after the news. It's 8 o'clock. Hello there. Lovely to have you company this mid-August. We're going to talk about friendships across class a little bit later in this hour. Very interesting, huge study that's just come from America. And also our August edition of The Pick, the best things to see, watch and listen to, which is always fun. In just under a month, the government will host its much-vaunted Jobs and Skills Summit. And it's shaping up to matter to the way we think about our economy, though a seat at the table won't be easy to come by. Attendance will be limited to around 100 participants. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has warned the participants it's a working summit, not a soiree. He wants people to bring fresh ideas. Now, we'll cover that summit in more detail when it happens, but some of those ideas are already being aired and some pushbacks emerging too. The ACTU this week released a report for the summit titled An Economy That Works for People, implying the pandemic offers a chance for a reset in our thinking. Dr. Jim Stanford's the report's author. He's an economist and director of the Centre for Future Work, which is based at the Australia Institute, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Do you think the pandemic has reset us?
I think we have the potential to reset ourselves. It won't happen automatically. But I do think the pandemic was a wake-up call. It's forced us to confront some issues that had been festering for a long time before the pandemic and then really kind of reached the breaking point. For example, think about how we had to value the essential services that people provided during the pandemic, not just the healthcare workers and first responders and so on, but everybody doing these jobs that we often considered disposable or menial jobs, like cleaners or carers or delivery drivers. How would we have gotten through without them? So the pandemic, in a way, opened our eyes to how essential those services are. And then when people started getting sick, I think particularly with the Omicron variant, and we saw hundreds of thousands of people staying away from work because they had COVID or had been exposed to COVID or were caring for someone with COVID, that was a sharp reminder that, in fact, it's human beings who make up the economy. You know, it isn't the All Ordinaries Index or the financial wheelings and dealings. It's human beings who have to get up and go to work. Otherwise, the economy grinds to a halt. So those are important lessons, I think, Geraldine, that set the stage for an honest discussion at this summit about what has worked and what hasn't worked in our economy in recent years.
Yes, the Hawke Keating government did something similar when it came to office in the 1980s, held this huge economic and tax summit. So I was a very young journalist and I went to that. Are you looking for something similar? I mean, out of that came, for instance, the massively important Prices and Income Accord, and the Business Council of Australia was formed because business realised that it just wasn't vaguely organised enough and the world of labour was, so the world of capital got its act together. Now, do you think something like that, or what would be the equivalent now?
I think the spirit of discussion is similar, Geraldine, to what was done in those years in the early 80s. But the economic conditions are night and day different. So I don't think anyone is expecting to have an accord, anything like the one that happened in the early 80s. I remember at that time, Australia had high inflation, just like it did now, but it was a very different world. You had unions that had very strong bargaining power. You had wages that had increased rapidly. You had workers that had expanded their share of total national output. And you had businesses that were complaining the profits were too low. Now turn almost every one of those things upside down, and that's where we're at today. Yes, we do have inflation, but it isn't coming from workers and wages, not remotely. It's come from obviously some of the particular challenges of the pandemic, the supply chains and the energy price shock and so on. But it's being manifested in a dramatic increase in profits, not in wages. And real wages are falling rapidly. So,
They're not falling rapidly. They're leveling off, aren't they? They're not rising off.
Real wages, that is to say, your wage after adjusting for inflation, is falling rapidly, about 3% in the last year. That's because the increase in wages is much less than the increase in prices. And that, again, is the opposite of what was happening in the 70s and the 80s. So if the last time was a sort of trying to find a compromise between strong unions and businesses, today it's going to be a different kind of compromise that has to be found. It has to be looking at how come businesses are doing so well at a moment when average households are having a hard time paying the bills.
Well, in fact, a key argument that your report makes is that there have been misguided responses to tackling rising inflation, and the Reserve Bank is squarely in your sights when you say that central banks are, quotes, willing to risk a deliberate recession in their crusade against inflation. Now, do you say that they have the wrong mission statement, or they need alternative tools to manage what they are managing?
I think a bit of both, frankly. The RBA, in theory, is guided by a charter that sets out multiple goals, including full employment and national prosperity. In practice, however, for the last 30 years, it's really been guided by one operational directive, and that is to try and keep inflation at its target level, which it thinks is best at 2.5% a year. Now, today it's over 6%, and it's probably going to rise a little further. So that hasn't worked out too well. And in pursuing this goal of getting inflation back to 2.5%, they have explicitly said, we'll do whatever it takes. And that does mean throwing a whole cold bucket of water over the economy and slowing things down.
But you know what? You know why they're doing that? Because, I mean, they're saying that this, what happened in the 70s, if inflation got out of control, it was actually poorer people who paid the greatest price, and they had to absolutely slam the brakes on economies to bring it back. So they're saying, let us tweak it now in order to make sure we don't have to go into that real sort of blunderbuss approach.
Well, in a way, I think this infatuation with what happened in the 70s is quite misguided because of the change in economic circumstances. In the 70s, unions were strong and real wages were growing. In this era, collective bargaining has collapsed and real wages are falling. It's corporate profits that are the driving force behind the inflation that we're seeing. So, again, I think there is a knee-jerk tendency at the RBA and other places to think, oh, we better clamp down on workers, otherwise we'll repeat the cycle of the 1970s, when in fact it's a different set of problems causing this inflation. And that's why this report argues for a more diverse toolbox, if you like. Right now, the only tool is, including fiscal policy, including regulatory policy around things like prudential lending and so on, to try and make sure that the credit that is issued through the banking system is used for more productive purposes. Also investments in supply chains and regulated energy prices, which have been some of the key sources of inflation that we've been experiencing.
So just go a little bit more into that. Would you be in there regulating what banks can lend and to whom, would you? Via the Reserve Bank.
Regulations. Yeah, the Reserve Bank itself doesn't handle the prudential lending rules, but they participate in a council of financial regulators and they communicate and cooperate with other agencies that do. So instead of just using that one sledgehammer, lift the interest rate or reduce the interest rate, lift the interest rate or reduce the interest rate, try and tailor the impacts of that so that you can discourage lending that's not helpful. Think about, say, the lending that fueled the property price bubble or some of the financial shenanigans like cryptocurrency and so on, and continue to encourage lending that is helpful, including lending in business capital investment and supply chains and infrastructure. Those are things we need to address the inflation that's come from supply chain crises.
You put quite a lot of effort into discussing the drop in business investment in particular.
Yes.
Now, which a lot of people have been talking about, but it goes into the back burner. And in fact, I think you draw a conclusion, but your words will be interesting to hear, that really there's been, the world of capital has been let off the hook ever since the beginning of this 21st century in terms of they're dropping an investment. What do you want of them? How do you want them to think ideally?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. What we really want is we want the surplus that's generated in our economy to be plowed back into the economy in terms of new capital investment, new technology, innovation, research and development, infrastructure, and so on. There's an incredible disconnect, Geraldine, right now between corporate profits, which are higher than they have ever been, ever in history, almost 30% of GDP going to corporate profits, but corporate investment, how much of that money is plowed back into, you know, whether it's tangible capital and new projects or innovation, R&D, 37 cents of each dollar of profits is all that's plowed back into the economy.
But so
what would you negative impact.
What would you do about that? Are you implying that in an ideal world that you'd like to see, there'd be some sort of insistence or some sort of regulation almost by saying, well, you, the world of capital, you have to plow a certain amount back, you know, which
right.
means that
yeah.
then you're fundamentally changing the relationship of the shareholder to the corporation, aren't you?
Well, there's a number of ways to go at it. The first and most obvious, Geraldine, is to ask, why are we giving them so much money in the first place? The whole logic of trickle-down economics is give more money to wealthy people and businesses that they own, and then they'll invest and start new jobs and businesses, and we'll all be better off. And that clearly hasn't happened. So first of all, we have to say, why are we giving 30% of GDP? That's about twice the long-term average to companies that aren't reinvesting. Secondly, for the profits that they are getting, is it legitimate or not? And one of the proposals in our report is for an excess profit tax in sectors like the energy industry, which have profited enormously from the inflation that you and I are paying for. That's a way to get some of that surplus and redistribute it to protect people. Finally, we can restructure our fiscal incentives so that there's more carrot, if you like, more incentive for businesses to actually do something with the money rather than what they're doing now, which is either hoarding it or investing it in other countries or paying it out in enormous special dividends or share buybacks for their shareholders. So there's lots of ways to get at that. The fundamental starting point, though, is that the logic of trickle-down economics, which is give these companies more money and they know what to do
when
with
you say
it.
What do you mean give the what
that,
do you
that's
mean
wrong.
What do you mean give these companies more money?
Well, we are giving them more money. We're giving them 30% of our GDP in gross profits. And some of that comes from the very sources of the inflation.
But they're making, doing the production. They're plunging, you know.
You know, that's an interesting point you make, because I'm often amazed at how much attention the RBA and government officials and so on pay to labor costs, okay? Like any increase in wages is considered an increase in the cost of production, and it's something to worry about. And they put out report after report on what's happening to unit labor costs. Nobody pays attention to profits and the share that they account for in total costs of production and the eventual prices that we pay, which is in a way a really biased thing. It's like workers have to have their income controlled lest it get out of control. But profits, well, that's just a return to investment and ingenuity right. and innovation. And that's nonsense. Profits have become a huge source of inflation. And rethinking the role of labor and business in explaining how we're producing and how we're not producing and why prices are growing so quickly, I think, is a top task for this jobs summit.
Now, look, another area that is mm-hmm. around productivity, which people like the Productivity Commission have just basically said this is just an enormously important issue for Australia, which we keep averting our gaze from because our productivity levels have really dropped quite considerably this century. And I want to read the Financial Review's editorial about your report that came out. The union peak body, once led by Bob Hawke, Bill Kelty and Simon Crean, is fundamentally unserious for our times. It doesn't get productivity, saying it's not the issue, defying wisdom that says it's almost always the issue. Instead, it wants to get straight on with redistribution, reversing the reform direction that began with the 1983 economic summit. So how do you answer that?
Well, look at the facts on productivity, which we present in the report. The productivity of the average Australian worker has never been higher So productivity has grown. It hasn't fallen. Now it's grown at a slower rate than it has in the past. And I would attribute that slowdown more to issues about the weak business investment and technology and innovation. But the key problem here, Geraldine, is that the increases in productivity that have been achieved, and they're not insignificant, 13% increase over the last decade in the amount of real output per hour of work, those have not translated at all into improved real wages and improved living standards for workers. There has been zero increase in real wages over the last decade. So productivity is growing, but workers who account for that productivity in the end through their labor are not getting any payback from it. But now we see real wages falling. So if we want to talk seriously about productivity, it has to be connected to a plan to make sure that the gains of productivity are shared. And right now, they aren't.
Do you think productivity could be better? Like, we've just had also you know, lack of complexity in Australian production generally, the tech industries screaming for workers.
No, 100%. Like, more export, absolutely. More technology. I mean, we have a situation where we're employers are complaining about a labor shortage, and that is forcing them to try to use labor more efficiently, to make the most of the workers that they can find. And gradually, we're going to see them using more technology and machinery and even robots. And this is a good thing. And in fact, since the pandemic, we've actually had a bit of an upsurge in productivity, growing at over 2% a year right now. But again, for that to be sustained, it has to be accompanied by measures to tie productivity growth to higher real wages. And that doesn't happen by itself. It doesn't happen by magic. It doesn't happen by supply and demand forces. It happens because we put in place structures and policies and institutions like collective bargaining to make sure that workers have a share and a chance to get some gains that go along with higher productivity.
Are you confident, final question, that if some of your ideas came through and we did have a reset, that this would be a dynamic economy attracting capital from overseas, growing jobs? Is that what you think would be the result? Or is it a sort of a flatter, better distributed, fairer, but flatter economy?
No, I think the fairness and the dynamism of the economy can go hand in hand. First of all, we don't need to attract capital from overseas. We've got swaths of capital right here in Australia that businesses are earning in profits but not reinvesting here. Now, I'm certainly open to getting more investment from overseas as well. I'd like to see more investment in technology and innovation and machinery from capital of any nationality, frankly. But what's clear is that the emphasis in the last generation on controlling inflation and controlling workers and controlling wages and controlling budget deficits hasn't paid off. We have not captured that dynamism, that innovation, and we're certainly not sharing the gains that we are generating with the people who work hard to produce it.
All right. Well, very interesting. As I say, it's going to make for a very interesting summit, I think.
Well, that was the idea, right? To put some ideas out there. So hopefully we've done that.
I could feel that. Okay. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Dr. Jim Stanford talking to us from Canada. You can hear that Canadian accent there. And if you look on the ACTU site, you can find that An Economy for People. And as I said, we'll be reporting on that summit with some detail when it comes up in early September. Well, up next, what happens when academics analyse 71 billion Facebook friendships? Yes, now to the results of this sociological research on a truly massive scale, using very contemporary tools. A fascinating American study that analysed these 21 billion Facebook friendships, chewing through the data to draw some conclusions about links and mobility across groups within communities. It really does throw some light, too, on deep areas of influence within families and children that clearly have very long-tail effects of the sort that many parents may simply not consider. This new study has found that low socioeconomic children who grew up in neighbourhoods where people have more friendships cut across class and economic lines far more than was generally realised. To talk us through the research and the potential implications, I'm pleased to welcome one of the authors of the study, Matthew Jackson. He's the William D. Ebel Professor of Economics at Stanford University, and alongside Raj Chetty of Harvard University and others, is the author of this academic study, Social Capital. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Geraldine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, let's step back from the sort of specifics and just ask how you did this. 72 million young American adults, I think, primarily, on 21 billion friendships was this data that you worked with, proprietary data from Facebook. How they let you have it, did they, and then analyze it?
Yes, indeed. And, you know, it speaks to the availability of modern data and the techniques that we have. I mean, this study couldn't have been done even a decade ago. So the computing power that was necessary, the size of the team, you know, it actually took us 6 years really to process the data and to really get a good look at it and understand it. So, you know, the scope and scale and the size of the team are things that were, you know, pretty much unprecedented in social science research.
And just the accuracy of this data, you know, the number of, I wonder just how you processed all of the people who start Facebook groups and then stop, and friendships and then stop, to making sure that it was accurate and up to date. Did that preoccupy you a bit?
Yes, indeed. You know, so the data are pretty amazing because, you know, the sheer number of people who are actively involved in Facebook and the footprint that you can see in terms of their friendship patterns and other things about them really is sort of unique. And it's daunting to go in. It's not like it's just a spreadsheet of data that you can just analyze. So actually, you know, part of it was figuring out how to extract the data in ways that we could use while still preserving the privacy of the individuals involved, but yet, you know, yielding good insights into what's actually happening.
What were your aims when you started this research?
Yeah, well, you know, there's an old adage, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. And there are questions of, you know, why do some children have better opportunities for success than others? And when we think about what it means to say it takes a village, you know, people usually talk about, okay, it's social capital. Well, what is social capital? You know, there's lots of different things. Does it mean that all my neighbors know each other and are friendly with each other? Does it mean that we all volunteer and help each other out? Or does it mean that, you know, that we're sort of well connected across class lines? And so we're looking at these different ways in which you could measure social capital. Is it how cohesive your group is, or how trustworthy it is, or is it, you know, that it connects well? And you know, so that was what we were looking at. And with Facebook data, you can see volunteering rates, you can see, you know, whether people are all friends with each other in local neighborhoods, you can see whether there's friendships that cut across class lines. And we could look at all those and then see what actually predicted whether a kid was going to end up, you know, rising out of poverty.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that's really sort of, I suppose, grabbed people's attention is that you essentially say that lower socioeconomic children who grew up in neighbourhoods where people had more friendships that cut across class and economic lines earned far more as adults, and that cross-class friendships are a better predictor of upward mobility than school quality, job availability, community cohesion, or family structure. It's a very interesting conclusion.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think it was pretty surprising to us how strong this predictor was. It seems to sort of trump pretty much every other measure you throw at the problem. And there's a lot of things that we knew mattered, as you're mentioning, you know, how educated is an area, how poor is an area, and so forth. But once you start controlling for whether or not there's these cross-class connections, a lot of those other things stop mattering. And so it seems that part of the reason that, you know, an area with poor people who are separated from the rich aren't advancing is because they don't have those connections. And, you know, similarly, if you have an area where you have lots of single parents that are working several jobs and so forth, it turns out that the kids tend to have fewer cross-class connections. Those places where they do have those connections, you know, the kids have a much better chance of having a successful adulthood, at least in terms of earning income.
What kinds of places do encourage interclass mingling from your research?
Yeah, so, you know, one part of the study that we did was eventually look at where friendships form. So we can see, you know, is this a high school friendship or is it a university friendship? Or is it a workplace friendship? Is it something was made in a church? So we go through different places in which friendships form, and then we can see which ones actually contribute the most towards these cross-class friendships. And it really does matter. So neighborhoods vary dramatically in how well they connect people. Different schools vary dramatically. Different universities vary dramatically. So there's a lot of heterogeneity in how these things happen. One thing that was really stood out was, you know, for instance, churches. Inside churches, people tend to connect across class lines. They aren't necessarily exposed, so churches tend to be segregated by income. But once you do get rich and poor people in the same church, they connect with each other.
Right, and whereas in universities, you suggest they don't.
Yeah, they tend not to. So universities are actually a good place for poor people to actually have exposure to richer people because, you know, there's a lot of richer people going to universities. But they vary dramatically in terms of how well they connect. And you know, there's a lot of universities that put, you know, could be half rich and half poor, but have these people essentially just never mingle with each other. And there's other universities that actually do a fairly good job of it. And so, you know, one thing we've put out is an atlas where people can actually look up different universities. You can look up different neighborhoods, different schools, and so forth. And it's quite telling how different different places are.
What about sporting clubs?
Sporting clubs also are another place where you see a lot more connections across class lines than you would other places. But again, you know, those are ones where they often are segregated by income level, but conditional on, you know, in situations where these people do are in the same clubs, they tend to mix much more than they would in a neighborhood or someplace else.
What is it exactly about these friendships that is so powerful? Did you tease that out a bit?
Well, I think, you know, that's one thing we want to understand better. You know, there's lots of hypotheses about these things. So why would it matter being connected to, you know, wealthier people? And I think, you know, the basic ideas are that it offers opportunities. For instance, you know, in the future, if I need a job, are my friends employed? Are they well employed? Can they offer me assistance in getting an interview? Do I know what it takes to go to university? Are there people around me who have gone to university? Can I see what they had to do to get into university and what the value is of doing it? What are my aspirations? You know, and a kid growing up looks to their peers and their friends for their aspirations and, you know, how they behave. Are they doing homework? Are they taking school seriously? Or you know, they have other things in mind. So all these things seem to play into it. And I think, you know, hopefully by putting all this data out there, we'll be able to learn more about what precisely is at work. But it's clear that having, you know, this exposure through these friendships really matters.
Is there a benefit for high socioeconomic friends in the relationship? Like, you focused on mobility from lower up, but what about the yield, or is there not one, for people who are sitting in much more privileged environments?
Yeah, I mean, so in the data, what we do see is that, you know, the cross-type friendships it doesn't drag down the people from the top, but we don't know what kinds of benefits they might be getting from it. In general, you know, you could imagine that they become more empathetic or they better understand other people's situations, that they have a better worldview. One thing we're planning to explore now is starting to look at people's friendships and how they evolve. So, you know, if I'm exposed to more people from another class, does that mean that now I become, you know, more connected to them and make more friendships than I would have otherwise? Or do I behave otherwise differently in the future? So hopefully the data will allow us to explore a lot more of these questions in detail.
Mm. I mean, mobility in Australia has traditionally been right up high, you know, in the world, considerably more, I think, than the US, for instance. But that has definitely been under challenge. I just wonder whether what sort of conclusions you've drawn about mobility, social mobility in the United States, say, in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's actually interesting in terms of the findings were they're pretty robust, so that when we look across different subregions of the U.S., urban, rural, richer and poorer, or, they have different cultural backgrounds, we seem to see the same patterns, when you cut it pretty thinly. And so a guess is that it's going to, we haven't reproduced it yet in other countries, but, Facebook data is Facebook usage is high in Australia, for instance. So, we can replicate this kind of finding in Australia and see how much of this is explaining what's going on there. And in Australia, mobility is higher, but it's also been under fire from, the increasing divide between people who have university educations and don't, right? So that, people with university educations are advancing a lot more than they used to relative to people who don't have that education. And I think worldwide, that's producing a bigger and bigger gap. And so I think that, the same kinds of insights will apply more generally, but it might be interesting to explore, what's different across different countries.
Yes, indeed. I think it'd be a fascinating study, and certainly it's playing a role in politics. I think people are realising more and more. Look, what do you think it does mean, this result that you've come up with for society? Should we forget, really, about or certainly sort of downgrade the importance of family structure or school quality in particular, which, a lot of people really think a great deal about, and focus on neighbourhoods and clubs that encourage this kind of cross-class relationship?
Yeah, I suspect that it's somewhat all of the above. Your family certainly matters. The school quality of the school and access to good teachers matters. But what this shows is that social capital is a non-trivial part of the puzzle, and really understanding when we look across schools, smaller schools tend to do much better in terms of connecting people across class lines than larger schools do. So that can be a lesson for large schools. If you've got a big school, a lot of times urban schools tend to be really big. If you want to be making sure that friendships form across economic divides, you want to make sure that the kids are actually put into smaller classrooms and not just separated out into, advanced honors courses and other, vocational courses where the students across class lines never see each other.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed. I think you should expand your range and do that bigger study you're talking about, which would be an extraordinary, that would be of a considerable scale. But thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Geraldine. It's been a pleasure.
Matthew Jackson, he's the William D. Ebell Professor of Economics at Stanford University. And they brought out, he and his colleague Raj Chetty, have brought out the academic study Social Capital, a development really of Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone in some ways, which of course is from many years back. Well, coming up next, some lovely suggestions in our August version of The Pick. Yes, now for another instalment of our very popular little feature. We have some great thought-provoking tips on what to read, watch and listen to. This month, we're joined by the historian and author Ian Hoskins, whose recent book, Australia and the Pacific, has just been nominated for the Australian History Prize. Hello, Ian. Welcome back.
Thank you, Geraldine.
We had a lovely chat about that earlier on Saturday Extra. And Jenny Gordon is also ready with her tips. Jenny is an economist and an honorary professor at the ANU in Canberra. She's also a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, it's lovely to be on.
Now, just let's start with what you're both reading. Now, Jenny, it's a bit of a blast from the past from you. You're recommending we dust off our copies of The Lucky Country by Donald Horne.
Absolutely, yes. It's sort of a sad circumstance. I was cleaning up my mum's home and I found my dad's old copies of The Lucky Country and also The Permit, which is well worth reading as well. And I was taking them over to Austria for my nephew to read because he's into all sorts of interesting books. And I started reading it on the plane and I went, I have to finish this. So I ended up bringing it back. And it's just really worth reading again because so much of it is still relevant to Australia today. So
how so?
Really
tell us what you
worth
mean.
A read. Well, it talks a lot about And the point of the lucky country is that we haven't had to work that hard. And so when we face a whole bunch of new challenges, we're not ready for them. And he talks a lot about a set of leaders who had kind of were so comfortable in how things were going that they didn't think that they needed to change. And the challenges that he lists, you know, communist Asia and things like that, haven't come to pass. But there's a new set of challenges. You know, that was the old domino theory back in the 60s that you're going to have all of Asia sort of fall like a domino one after the other to communism. And you still clearly have challenges from Asia, and so, but also opportunities. So it's just full of kind of very relevant information, I think, and makes you think.
And you suggested to our producer that we're at a point where maybe the Australian people did deserve better from our leaders, business leaders and political players, as we face a pretty huge time in our history. So I thought that was sort of quite thought-provoking, you know?
Well, I think some of the lines is that it sort of goes in, you know, it's a first-rate country run by second-rate people. You know, and if you think about leading up to this, we had massive change. As an economist, I'm kind of into this kind of thing. You know, we had massive change in the 70s for a while, and then it was really the reforms of the 80s that fundamentally shifted the way the Australian economy was. I mean, we, you know, in the 70s, we got rid of the White Australia policy. That was a massive change. We brought in, you know, equal pay for women and, you know, so all sorts of massive changes. And I feel like with the challenges of climate change, the shifting power dynamics of, you know, the US and China, we're also at that point where Australia has to actually sort of really think about itself differently and think about its place in the global economy differently.
Well, that was exactly what my previous interview was discussing, you know, whether we need to refresh ourselves and think differently. I note you also say that you went back to Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs and Steel as an old favourite. So your sort of interests are quite revealing in a sense.
They are rather. And the last interview was terrific too, because I actually was very lucky and had an office next to Bob Putnam back in the Centre for International Affairs at Harvard a long time ago when he was writing his seminal work on Italy. And so that whole, as an economist, that whole issue of social capital and how we develop arm's length relationships and can trust people is actually really fundamental, because it sits behind all our assumptions around market economies and things like that. And so it was just really interesting to try and bring those aspects into economic models. And so, and it's just wonderful to see that, you know, this kind of work goes on, and it still really matters. So I guess from my perspective, I think we can never think enough about history and how we got to where we are in order to change where we're going.
Well, that was Eva Cox's whole thesis with her Boyer Lectures all those years ago, was the nature of trust and how critically important it was in the type of society that we've created. And Ian, you're also looking back. I think this is very interesting. It wasn't the plan.
I'm a historian. That's all
yes,
I ever do.
But you're also going back to Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman, which of course turns out to be an earlier version of To Kill a Mockingbird, the great classic.
Yes, it was published in 2015. I got my copy a few years ago, but it sat on the shelf unread, and I've been looking at it, and having finished the Pacific book and a few other commitments, now's the time to delve into literature, which I often don't get to do. And I read them first to Kill a Mockingbird, revisited that, and then read Go Set a Watchman. And it was just such a revelation, because the Atticus Finch character was a hero to many for obvious reasons. He was the lawyer who defended the man who was wrongly accused of rape and ends up getting shot, but not technically lynched, as the fate of so many black men were at the time. So we end that book thinking highly of Atticus, and it's a wonderful book for many reasons. But the Go Set a Watchman, written earlier in 1957 and thought to be a draft of Mockingbird, set in the 50s, Mockingbird set in the 30s. How that creative process works, I don't know, because it reads like a sequel. Atticus Finch was a member of the Klan, is revealed, and is a segregationist. And Jean Louise, who's the scout, our the wonderful hero of Mockingbird, is so disillusioned with her father that she just tears strips off him. I was reading that section when you were doing your interview with Sarah Churchwell, literally in that morning. Yeah, chomping on a bagel and drinking coffee. And that's what prompted my email to you, which you kindly read out last week, because I was so affected by her reaction to her father, her disillusionment, and Atticus. But it provided some insights into what's going on in the States today with... Look, it's a new revival of white supremacy and a new fight against what you might call Reconstruction, that period after the Civil War where there was some attempt to implement racial equality, and the South won that because they got to lynch and mutilate and rape with impunity for the next 50 years. And then there's the Civil Rights Movement, and that's when Go Set a Watchman is set. So I really encourage people to read that book. Read, if you haven't already read it, or perhaps revisit it, Mockingbird first and then Go Set a Watchman. And it's,
well,
yeah.
How did it happen? I mean, I know this is not the first time this has been discussed, but how was she prevailed upon, Harper Lee, by the publisher to tone down that Go Set a Watchman in her relationships? Because, I mean, it became a very different book, didn't it?
It did. I actually don't know, so I'm not going to conjecture, but I have a feeling, my understanding is that it was her reworking, because they are totally different books. Mm. They are totally different. And what is so beautiful about Mockingbird is that it's the world through the eyes of an eight-year-old girl, which written in 1960 and set in the 30s, in itself is transgressive from a gender point of view. I mean, she is not belittled at all through that book. She is sassy and intelligent right to the end. So that is remarkable. I don't know what prevailed upon Harper Lee to rewrite that and write, in a sense, a prequel to the book that was the draft. Mm. And she sat on it until she was prevailed upon in 2013 or whenever it was, because it was published in 15, to release that other manuscript. And there have been conjectures about whether she was prevailed upon too much, whether she was fully equipped to... say,
well,
yes or no, yes.
Actually, one of our listeners has just said, this is a misreading of Go Set a Watchman. Atticus is not a Klansman.
No, he was a member 40 years earlier. That's mentioned very distinctly.
There's no doubt about that, isn't
there? Yeah. And he puts on a hood just to see what they're doing. He joins just so he can get an insight. But he's on the Citizens Council in the 1950s. And I can read a very quick extract. Mm. This is Atticus to Jean Louise in Go Set a Watchman. Have you ever considered that you can't have a set of backward people living among people advanced in one kind of civilization and have a social Arcadia? And there are worse sentiments there. So it is about segregation. There is one group of people who are below another. Now, he believes in the law. He doesn't believe in lynching, and hence his earlier defence of...
his advocacy.
Yeah. We're based in part on... Harper Lee's own father, who was a lawyer in the 20s and defended black men who were subsequently lynched. So, yes, there's very little doubt that Atticus is a segregationist, and he was a Klansman, not a murdering Klansman.
In fact, in Sarah Churchwell, there was so much to talk to her about, but I mean, she does point out in her book that actually some of the people who were very strong abolitionists actually didn't want to mix, though, with... people of different colour. So this is a very interesting sort of, I don't know, subtext of the whole discussion in America, is terribly delicate.
It is, but I keep seeing images of raging white mobs with, you know, men with guns and nooses out front of the Capitol building. There was a noose there on January 6th.
There was.
And their great-grandfathers are the men who looked at the camera with a body swinging in the breeze behind them with impunity. That's the connection I'm making.
So maybe there's progress. Yes, okay, all right. Well, Go Set a Watchman. Go back. I haven't read it yet. Now, listening, let's get some picks for what to listen to. Now, Jenny, I think podcasting is your medium of choice by the sound of it. What have you been enjoying?
Yes. There is so much good stuff out there. I'm waiting for... Matt Bevan to do another Australia America, China, Russia, Are You Listening series. I don't know which one's coming next, but, no. But that's always, they're always well worth listening to. I think all your, many of your listeners, because I know you have such a great interest in foreign affairs, would already listen to Darren Lim's and Alan Gingell's Australia in the World.
Yes.
I think that's
they haven't put one out for a while. I'm a bit annoyed with them.
Yeah, I know.
They must be busy.
But it is, it's fun because, you know, Darren takes that kind of academic, well, how do we put this to a model, which, you know, appeals to me, and then you've got Alan's kind of years and years of experience and the two of them just hit it off really well. So you get some sort of interesting takes and rethinks and it's a way we should be doing, you know, analysis, which is to think about how do we explain things and then how do we put around them, you know, test them against reality and what insights do we get if we try and think about things in different ways. And so that's always fascinating. And can I add another one, which is a really fun one by the BBC? It's by Greg Jenner, which is You're Dead to Me. And so he did Horrible Histories.
Oh, yes.
And so he now does, you know, it's just you get these little snippets, well, quite substantial periods sometimes in history that I don't know a lot about. The Australian education system wasn't long on, you know, anything other than Tudors, I think. So, but anyway, it's really great because it's always interesting and they do it in a fun way. And I must admit the comedians are better at the pop quiz at the end than I am.
Yes, you know, it pairs a comedian with an academic expert, doesn't it? Academic expert.
Yes, that's right. Mm.
And what about you do suggest also the economics-themed cautionary tales.
Oh, yes, that's a fun one. People should definitely get onto that one. So Tim Hartford is a well-known economist and it starts off because he loves disasters. And so trying to explain why disasters actually happen, and some of them are quite amazing. There's one where a whole dance floor collapsed and then you go back and work out that somebody decided that the particular bolt, the way it was designed, couldn't be built that easily, so they sort of did a makeshift change. And it's a tiny change, and yet that tiny change put that whole structure at risk and it actually fell down and killed quite a lot of people, which is very sad. But it's about getting back to what actually was the thing that went wrong in this, and what's the cautionary tale part of it is. Usually it's not the obvious that you think it is. Usually it's something else that is actually fundamentally behind what's gone wrong. So that's a great one to listen to.
Actually, one of our listeners has just come in and said, the choice of reading this morning reveals possibly a little bit of laziness. There's always good reason to read old classics. I could name many, but really there is so much writing reflecting the modern age. This is Gavin.
Gavin.
He wants you both
again,
to.
I'm a historian, you know, and I'm always playing catch-up.
Okay, now, what about you listening? I'm intrigued by your choice, Ian. It's big, it's certainly atmospheric, and it features an Australian singer. Here's a little taste. That's from Black Hawk Down, Hans Zimmer.
Hans Zimmer. So Black Hawk Down was made 2002, so it's 20 years ago.
And here you go again.
I know. But this is serendipity in the way that to Ghost Out of Watchmen was serendipity. I just picked these up for nothing. So I picked this CD up. I'd liked Hans Zimmer's music for Dunkirk. I mean, he's what John Williams isn't to me. I'm not a John Williams fan, but I love Hans Zimmer's understatement and the way he just plays with sound. And this just blew me away. I didn't know what to expect. I'd seen the movie, but the soundtrack, oddly enough, hadn't stayed with me because it's full of action, so there's plenty of other things to look at. And this is extraordinary. And it's a collaboration. So Hans Zimmer's written quite a lot of the music, but not all of it. The track you heard was Lisa Gerrard, who's an Australian singer. I had no idea about that. No. Before I did a bit of research for this morning, a collaboration with a Breton musician and singer Denis Prigent. I assume that's how you say his surname. And that track, I mean, that type of ambient music can very easily flip over into a bit of Muzak and Kitsch. Yeah, but it moves me every time. There's Rakid Tara, who's, I think, an Algerian musician. There's Baba Mal, who's a Senegalese. So it's not the equivalent of the African equivalent, because it's set in Somalia, of Orientalism. I mean, there's evoking the East Africa or whatever, and Hans Zimmer's German. So there's a danger there. But I don't think it does do that because of the diversity of the musicians. And Joe Strummer's version of Minstrel Boy, which is a tradition, it was an Irish poem set to music. I mean, at the end of the day, with a glass of wine, listening to that, and there's a bit of sort of African heavy metal, so it's not all what you've just heard. It just lets you sit down and think of
I'm just thinking, because in that classic, the recent classic Countdown, which was of screen music for the screen, Hans Zimmer, of course, I became very aware of how remarkable Hans Zimmer is. I just can't remember whether they did Black Hawk Down. I didn't think they did, but maybe that someone will ring me, Martin Buzzacott will ring me and say I'm wrong.
If you can't find a CD, it might be on one of the streaming things, but... Yeah, okay, I have a CD with liner notes, so I love that.
And just staying with you, Ian, for your TV recommendation before I come to Jenny, it's the new TV series starring Jeff Bridges as a former CIA operative, the old man. Here's a taste.
Hello?
Hey, kid, it's me. They found me.
Dad, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. The dogs are fine. Thought I covered the tracks. You and I, we're not going to be able to talk again. Remember that I love you, that I'll always love you. I'm on a plane to Morocco tomorrow.
What is happening?
I want to understand how your world works.
Come with me, I'll tell you everything. I'm a
rabbit. Sounds like the old man is in for a rough time. Jeff Bridges is a fabulous actor, most underrated in my opinion. Why did it get to you?
Well, it got to me. I've just clocked over into old age myself. So Jeff Bridges, the scene begins with him with bladder problems, getting up several times in the morning. But he is a ex-CIA operative, so he can handle himself and all the rest. So there's me clinging on to some degree of hope. But so it's all that stuff which I love, you know, backstory in Afghanistan and, you know, the tough old guy. But the female actors in it have wonderful roles. There's Amy Brenneman, who you might remember from NYPD Blues and Judging Amy, I think. Neither are we. Oh, NYPD Blues was a favourite. I don't remember the other. Alia Shawcott is a young American actor. And Liam Lubani, who I've seen in several things, they're just great. So their relationships are wonderful. It's not written... just for guys. Those characters.
Okay.
Yeah. Whenever you think that he's going to take over because he's the alpha, Amy Brenneman will surprise you.
Oh,
so
lovely.
That's great.
Can I see it? Like, is it free to wear?
Oh yes. No, it's not free to wear. No. It's
Netflix.
I think it's on one of those subsets of Disney, like grown up Disney.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't pass the Alison Bechdel test. So there's never two women speaking to each other, but it's the old man. So if you can. Excuse that, then it's beautiful.
Good, good. And Jenny, finally, you're giving Auntie a good plug with the new David Wenham series, The ABC Of.
Yes, we just sort of fell over it. I think it was Will Anderson was on the night that we sort of had turned the telly on. And it combines the film clips from the ABC archives. And so you can sort of see people being confronted by bits of their past that have been captured, you know, on ABC film. And it forces them, you know, they get really thoughtful and, you know, takes them back in a way that just asking questions wouldn't. And so it's that beautiful use of the film footage that triggers memories and just leads to a really interesting discussion. And then, you know, having grown up in Australia in the period of Auntie Jack, I love the Gary McDonald one to sort of see the old black and white footage of Auntie Jack and I'll rip your bloody arms off. And then also Mother and Son, which was fantastic with Ruth Cracknell. So it's just, it's had John Howard, it's had Yvonne Goolagong Cawley. It's just had this great lineup of people and well worth watching.
Well, look, thank you both very much. That's a lovely wide range, and you're clearly having fun. So thank you very much indeed, despite any sort of suggestions of laziness.
Contemporary. I'm so contemporary, Pip.
Ian Hoskins.
For your lazy person, if I can say, I've also got on my table here Rethinking Social Media and Extremism, which is just out.
All right.
By Shirley Leach.
And Paul well Pickering. Done. Well done. So, okay. Thank you very much indeed, Jenny Gordon. And look, I'm just before we go, we had a very good response to our rewilding story last week, and Robin Williams is following that up this week on The Science Show with Dr. Jeremy Leggett, has a vast estate in Loch Ness where he's rewilding, paradoxically, smashing down alien exotic trees but allowing native forest and peatland to return. CO2 recaptured and biodiversity saved. So all of that awaits you. My thanks today to our great team, Sky Doherty, Margie Smithhurst and Belinda Summer, Anne-Marie de Bettencourt on the tools, and my pleasure to now welcome Jonathan Green with Blueprint for Living. Bye-bye.
Geraldine, good morning. Blueprint coming up. A program, we fall into line with the objectives of National Science Week and talk trees. We'll be talking Eucalyptusdom, a wonderful show at Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. That's about trees. We talk about urban trees in our cities and towns. Are they under stress? That's tree-ish. Paul Bangay talks about lawns. That's not very tree-ish at all, but never mind. Coming up, ABC RN.